Welcome to episode 13 of the Rum School podcast. Today's guest is Miguel Pereira. He's actually the England 2021 110 meter hurdles champion. So Miguel has quite a wide range of athletic events. He'll talk you through them. I have not got the time to go or the patience to go through all 15 of them. But Miguel has been competing since he was a young athlete. He's one of the athletes that's gone through the ranks and is very, very close to the international ranks at the moment. So, Miguel, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. So we'll go through your events. And I did touch upon you having quite a wide range of events. So can you talk us through the reason for your the wide range of events that you've taken part in?
Yeah, well, I think when I was younger, I never per se really felt like specialised in anything one particular, in any one particular event. I kind of wanted to do everything, particularly as a junior. I mean, the older you get, the more you have to specialise just because it's the complexity, the older you get. You know, you want to be technically fine with everything you do, but when you're a kid, you know, you jump into anything and everything, and whether that's throwing or jumping. I mean, for me, I was definitely more jumping inclined, more running inclined, but for me, it didn't bother. Like, I didn't mind coming last as long as I got to throw a javelin. To me, that was awesome. But I flirted with the idea of doing multi-events in recent times, but it's I think the hurdles is for me, so I drifted towards that for sure.
Okay, and so you mentioned that you were sort of drawn towards jumping and running as a young athlete, and that's hurdling is a combination of both. So when do you think that you realised that like hurdling was for you? That was the event you wanted to focus on.
To be fair, hurdles has always been my best event. To be fair, I never truly decided to like really set the other events aside and specialize in it until my first year of university. Until that point, it was, you know, I'll go to league meetings and representing Harrow at club level, and I'd just go and do whatever the team manager had put me up for. You know, if it was high jump, I mean, I did high jump a lot. That was definitely my second event, but you know, high jump, maybe the four hurdles, throw a javelin for some points, do some relays. But I think, definitely when I was 19, first year uni, that was definitely when I sort of felt like I had to specialise. You know, the way coaching setups tend to be at a senior level is that it is sort of, right, you either bank in and invest in this one event or sort of don't bother. Either you choose one or you choose combined events, which can be a bit of a shame. But, you know, given the sort of the calibre of the athletes you have to compete against, it to a degree, it does make sense. And if you really are talented that you can feasibly manage training for, let's say, a long jump, hurdles and javelin, then, you know, power to you. But, I think you do get to a point where you kind of want to pick your best event and then throw everything into it. See, you know, what's the highest level I can get to?
And do you think that your spending time doing other events also, did that keep things fresh, or did that sort of filter out events that you did? Did that help for you to select hurdles, or as you said?
To be fair, when I went to a competition, the bare minimum is I wanted to do hurdles. I did sprinting. I was a fast kid, and you know, at school level, I wouldn't get beaten at hurdles, and I might have done the other events. So for me, I liked winning, you know, as any kid does. And I always gravitated towards that. But I also did like the variance, as you said, like when I go to a competition, as a kid, you're thinking to yourself, right, I'm going to a club meeting, a YDL or what, a YAL as it used to be known. And you do, one event that lasts 14 seconds or 10 seconds, whatever the distance was. Day's over. You've traveled two hours to go down to, I don't know, Basildon or something, and then
just do one.
it's a bit of a shame, really. You're thinking, what is that? It do I go home now? You know, can I do some more? So it was fully that. It was the other things, like, okay, what can I do?
Just keep it interesting.
For sure. And to be fair, the older you get, the more focused you are on the actual race itself. I don't think I ever, as a junior, really went to races and was thinking considerably about who I was going to race against or race technique or anything like that. I think it was more just, I want to go and have a race, see what time comes up, and then go and enjoy the day, go and do some, you know, some high jumps, some long jump, and whatever I could get up to on whilst competing.
That's a good attitude to have. So to date, what would you, I might know the answer, there's other listeners may know the answer already, but what would you class as your proudest achievement in the sport so far today?
I mean, for me, the biggest thing when I started getting to senior level, my attention definitely turned towards, you know, getting representative vests. Mm. And for me, you know, I think as it is much the case for many athletes, is getting picked for either, you know, your home nation or the full, you know, GB call up. It's a massive deal, and you get to this point where you start to idolize just wearing the vest, and there's some sort of you know, aura about it. It's very strange. So for me, I mean, the England, when I got my first England call up for the Loughborough International, that was a huge deal, because I'd been sort of knocking on the door of making an England vest for a while, but never really quite got over the line. But I, for me, would be the World University Games, when I got picked for that for Great Britain. I mean, that was an incredibly surreal day. I remember waiting by the window for the van to drop off the kit, because that was the day. I mean, that's the thing I remember more than even the competition.
Yeah, because the competition. Yeah, and where was that, Miguel?
Napoli, in Naples, in Italy.
Wow.
Yeah, the competition itself went horrendously bad, but the actual getting selected for me and all that went into the preparation to qualify for that was massive, because I had World University Games, you have basically like to qualify by mid-May, which
that's very early
for a British athlete, you know, with the weather conditions we have, that's very short. So I remember I was sort of doing races in like Bucks and stuff, and I remember that one year when I actually ran close to stand, or ran the standard, it was, I think it was like 6 degrees, which
it's not ideal.
And it was a plus 2.3 in one race, and then a minus 3.7. It was just absolute nightmare.
Just
to be able to get picked was an incredible deal.
So it was getting picked to go to the GB, the University Games. Yeah, and that was that 2 years ago, 3 years ago, or
that was 2019. Yeah, it's 2 years
2019.
Ago.
2019. Okay, so. Yeah, just before lockdown then, possibly. Yeah, that sort of time. Yeah. Okay. Well, so for a lot of the listeners out there, that hurdling is quite a special. It's a very specialist event. Like, if anyone watches hurdles, you see, if I'm right, the hurdles are 1 meter, 10, 15. Is that right?
One meter seven.
1 meter seven. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I know steeplechase, 91 centimeters. 1 meter seven. And I do steeplechase occasionally, and I've got far more time to run through them. So you're faced with, how many is it, 12?
How 10. Many
barriers? 10. Okay, so 10 barriers that are 1 meter seven high. And not a lot of time, you know, you are approaching very, very, very quickly and at rapid speed. So can you talk us through the, I know this is quite an open question and you feel free to go and say it as much as you want, but talk us through the training that is involved to be a top class hurdler.
I think the training very much depends on your age as well. But to be fair, I didn't really train before I was 19, so I don't have considerable experience training as a junior, but as a senior, you have to focus up as if you're a sprinter, because fact of the matter is, if you're not fast over 100 meters, then you're getting washed out, and that's the tough reality for a lot of hurdlers who come up the ranks, is that you know, when you were younger, you could get away with being technically efficient, and you could see success that way, but when you get to a senior level, if you're not fast, you're going to struggle. So a lot of what we do is definitely designed around very well, it's very similar to a sprinter's training program. So, you know, we will do with elements of different things thrown in. That what typically coaches will say is that 110 hurdles is sort of the same type of lactic system as would be required for 200 meters because of the hurdles and having to go over. So you have to be conditioned to do a 200 meters. You then have to be fast enough to run 100 meters and a 200 meters. And then you have to have the element of the technical sessions. So you might have one or two technical sessions a week. And it depends on what time of year you're in, of course, naturally. Yeah, if you're in the October, November months, you're doing the heavy bulk, you know, the speed endurance runs and circuits to build that base. But, you know, you get to November, December, April, May time, and you'll be throwing in 2 to 3 technical sessions. That's really looking at clearing the hurdle, but also effectively running between them, because the technique is not the same as sprinting. So you can't just run at it the same way you would, you know, come out of the blocks in a 100 meter race. But, you know, as well.
So can I just go back there? Yeah. So do you tend to do hurdles? So your specific hurdle runovers, would you do that? That'd be after the block of speed endurance. So would you sort of start doing more hurdles sort of late December? Is that right? Sort of January time?
When I was in my first training group in back at Loughborough University, we didn't go over a hurdle, like a hurdle beyond 91 centimeters until December time.
Okay.
It would just be speed stuff, all without the hurdles, technical drills that might be running drills, running mechanics. Stuff like that.
Okay.
And then, you know, as you say, like speed endurance runs, so split 300, split 400, maybe just 20-minute runs, that kind of stuff.
Right. And in terms of your, so like in terms of the, like watching a hurdler, they've got immense mobility. And what do you do if you aren't running over hurdles? What are you doing to maintain and improve your mobility?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question because my mobility is horrendous. I get away with it because I've got long legs and I'm quite tall. I'm about 6'2", so and I've got longer legs than I'd say probably an average 6'2" person would have. So I can get away with a bit more. But mobility is definitely something I have to put a lot of attention into, because I am not naturally built that way. And that it works in hand somewhere. In some cases, so, you know, for me, I don't have to struggle with snapping my leg down because it wants to go down. There's no other, but in terms of how I would prepare for it, I mean, even competition stuff, like sometimes the day before competition, I'm spending 6 hours just sitting in a stretch whilst I'm watching Netflix, doing some work, depending on whether I was a student or not. And I would have to do that because otherwise I wouldn't be able to attack the hurdle, the technique I want to. But the best way, that was sort of like try to resolve it the day before thing. The best thing to do is to throughout the year, the best time to do it really is before training or after training is rolling the muscles and doing the stretches that would be required to enable that mobility. So, you know, most of it around the hips and the hamstrings. It always depends on, you know, what was your lead leg, what's your trail leg and stuff like that. But in terms of mobility as well, like you get a great deal of results from doing hurdle drills. So, you know, going over the side of them, going over the top of them, walkovers, that all builds. Because ultimately, if you have great mobility, but you can't apply speed to it as well, then it's not practical, it's not effective, exactly. There's also that element to it. And you can sometimes see it when you're training with sprinters and, you know, you're doing sort of some dynamic drills or stretches and they're sort of not really pushing their range. And you're thinking, God, I wish I could be like that, but I don't have a choice. Because if I don't do this,
you can't get over it.
And it's going to hurt a lot more hitting them for a whole summer season than otherwise. And the fact of the matter is, if you've not got the mobility in place, then you're just not going to run fast. It depends. Like if you're a shorter hurdler, then you do have to do a lot more mobility. You have to be more agile than someone who's taller who can get away with, you know, stepping over, rolling over hurdle, as opposed to taking it from further and getting that range. And really questioning your hamstrings. And
so when you hurdle, when you race, do you use one, you just go, you have a lead leg and trail leg, do you switch, do you alternate?
Yeah, so if you're a full hurdler, you would switch. But for me, but I don't sprints, switch ever. I've never gone over a hurdle with the other leg.
I guess if you did, you would have lost your stride pattern. Yeah, of course.
Well, it's just, it's for me. I've never trained that side of my body to hurdle that way. Okay. So I can give it a go, but over full height hurdles, I would never dare try. Go over on the other side with the other leg.
Okay.
It'd be an absolute disaster.
So do you think then, you alluded to it already, but if you were to get a bit more mobility in your, is your left leg, your right leg your lead, or your left leg?
Which left leg my lead, right trail.
Yeah, so if you got, if you were able to get a bit more hip mobility in your, is that something you're trying to address? Because I'm not saying necessarily that you've got a bit more mobility to make you faster, because you still have to put it into, because it can change the way that you go over, and you need to put it into practice, but is that an area that you've addressed that you can make gains, or do you think that you're better off focusing on just improving your speed, endurance, and your reaction time and your start?
It's a tricky question to answer. For me, it's an easy question to answer, but to give an answer that would sort of suit everyone would be tricky, because everyone has a different advantage and disadvantage to the way they take on a hurdle race. For me, absolutely, doing mobility is a massive thing, because I've already have a good amount of speed out the blocks and top end. My inefficiencies come from having a lack of mobility and being able to apply the speed. You know, if you're a sprint hurdler and you're running, but you have to take off closer because you don't have the hamstring mobility to stretch and reach.
Yeah, you're not getting. You're not
carrying the speed through, so it doesn't help. But let's say you are a really flexible athlete and you're able to get that range, but you're also moving really slowly, then as efficient as you are, it doesn't help you considerably.
It's not going to get you going faster.
So for me, my problem for a long time has not been not being fast enough. It's being inefficient. And largely as a result of my mobility. And I would feel it. I would know the day I'd rock up to a competition, if I could, comfortably, fit and put my wrists to the floor, then I knew, okay, good, I'm in great shape, I can run something fast.
Right. Okay.
Rather than if I felt like I was moving fast, doing a stride out, that was for me the determinant in whether I was going to have a good time that day or not.
It's different for you. It's something you could address. So your PB at the moment is
13.85.
Okay. So for listeners out there, the world record is, it's under 13. Remind me what it is.
12.80.
Okay. So that's not a million. That's to anyone out there, anyone's not heard that, that's nothing. That's one, just over a second. That time has come down. Am I right that you broke 13 last year? Was it?
It's been a tough one since COVID. I mean, 14, I broke 14 for the first time in 2018.
Oh, okay.
The thing is, I had a bit of misfortune in 2019. So I ran 13.7 several times, but I had 2.1, 2.2. Obviously don't count, right? And then I had a few times where I definitely would have run something fast and hit a hurdle and got set back. And last year was the most consistent season. I PB'd last year by a little bit. But, given that I changed groups and the whole COVID situation, I think I ran a PB after having to quarantine for 2 weeks because my mom and brother had COVID.
Wow.
Which was surprising. So the thing I was sort of thinking and juggling with as well is that, okay, cool. So what happens when I don't have these obstructions in the way? It's come down. So I think when I was 19, 18, my PB was about 15.4. So to go from 15.4 to 13.8 is a big chunk off.
Yeah.
I was never a junior success. I wasn't like one of those athletes who was English schools finalist or English schools champion stuff. And at a senior level, most of the people I race against You know, they were
yeah, okay,
at least in finals.
Late developer.
I was very much a late developer. I was like 5'5" when I was 17, so I had to learn the hard way. I mean, I remember the days of struggling to reach the hurdle, whilst people I race against nowadays, they were telling me I was struggling to fit it between. There was some incredible, you know, trials and tribulations of when you develop, for sure. I'm kind of glad that I developed at a later date, just because I learned a lot of lessons and a lot of perseverance through that. And it's very easy to get egotistical when you have such success as a junior. The fact that I was not
given
doesn't
mean that, anything, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I think the thing is, the problem is that athletes who had the success younger, they had to learn the hard way. That no one cares. That's great. Everyone cared, for sure. Like, it was a big deal if you were an English champion back in the day. But no one cares if you're an English schools champion.
No athlete wants to end their career as an English schools champion. They want to be a senior athlete, and that is what people look at. So that's a real lesson there about perseverance and just resilience. And it's quite interesting that those hurdlers are still going. If you look at other events, there are a good percentage of athletes at the top that have gone through English schools, but it's not particularly high. There's quite a lot that just dropped off. So it's quite interesting that you're saying you're surrounded by quite a few that have got to that level and still kept gone through senior ranks. So again, from my point of view as a middle distance athlete and someone that does cross country, there's always, for me, something to look forward to. So I've got cross country, I've got indoors in World One, I've got the summer season. So talk us through, as a hurdler, how do you remain motivated from say September through till December? That's assuming you're doing indoors. If you're not doing indoors, then that you're looking at 6 months there. Talk us through how do you keep motivated?
I think the trickiest time is definitely October, November, because that's the period of time where, I mean, you come off the back of April or at the end of August, and you have all the hype of, okay, I've achieved this much, or I haven't achieved it, and so I have to come with a vengeance to make up for that. And so for a whole month, you're whilst you're actually resting, because you have to rest after your whole competition season, you're thinking, oh, I can't wait to get back, can't wait to get back. Then you actually get back, and you have this weird, awkward period where you're doing base level training. You're not really doing any technical stuff. You're yearning to get back on the blocks, but you're not going to be doing so for for at least 2 months. It's a very strange period of time. For me, I always do indoors. Indoors is actually, that's probably my favorite. I love the indoors. I love competing indoors. I think it's fantastic.
It's good fun.
I used to do a lot of, and this doesn't help your case as a cross country runner, but I used to do a lot of rugby and stuff like that. And I used to hate the cold. I was like, Jesus, it's muddy, it's cold, it's raining. And I'm thinking to myself, so I get to race for 7 seconds in a warm room. Yeah,
perfect. That's it. No wind.
Enclosure room, no wind.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. Perfect. And you often get multiple attempts as well, because they can easily pack out two rounds of hurdles or 60s, you know. So for me, it's I'm always motivating myself with the champs. And it's been harder to do so since I came to senior level, because suddenly you go from being, okay, I want to do European under 23s or world unis and stuff like that, where the standards are high, but, you know, they're not quite, you know, bang up here. Yeah. Now the thing is, okay, cool, you want to make a GB team, you have to run the Olympic standard. You have to run the world standard, which are the same, you know, so it gets to that point.
What are they now? Because they do change them sometimes, don't they?
Yeah, so it's 13.32.
Okay.
So I'll take off about half a second, which is not without beyond the realms of possibility. For Commonwealth Games, it's 13.62, I think.
Okay.
But to be fair, even then, like, everyone's English, so it doesn't matter whether you are trying to qualify for Commonwealth Games or World Championships. They're all as difficult as one another.
Yeah.
So, but I still motivate myself with that and running certain times and beating people, because for me, there's nothing greater than crossing a line and seeing a time that you wanted to to run, and sort of go back to what you're saying about greatest achievement. The thing I actually remember as well considerably is crossing the lines and looking and seeing, you know, 13:72 on a clock.
Wow.
And yeah. I'd never seen that before, and that to me was a huge deal. So when I'm doing any training or something, I'm always thinking about that time that I want to run, or that championships that I want to qualify for. And in at this time of the year, for me, it's World Indoors. I want to qualify for that, or at least run the world standard and be within the shout. You know, the least I can do is run the standard if I don't make it, because people beat me or people run faster.
Yeah.
It is what it is. Okay. But at least I put myself within a shout.
Okay. So what would you say when you're growing up, or even now, who is your inspiration, or who were your inspirations?
That's a very good question.
It's not easy.
It's tricky.
You've got to say your dad, haven't you, first of all?
Yeah.
If you listen to this, you get upset if you didn't say him.
Yeah, I think my dad was there for me a lot when I was competing. In fact, my mum actually was a person who tried to get me into athletics, and she was like searching for a club. And my mum, even though the internet existed, my mum didn't have a clue what the internet was. You know, Google was in its infancy or whatever, but she tried to look for clubs for me and ultimately failed. The good thing was that eventually, through my school teacher, Steve Lowe, I managed to come through to Harrow. He was a massive inspiration for me, to be fair. He gave me my opportunities first and foremost. And my dad was always there to take me to competitions. You know, bless him. I remember once I asked him to drive me all the way to Sheffield for England indoor champs, and that was the day before the actual event. And he looked at me like, you've got to be joking, right? Went up there and came sixth in my heat, and then drove all the way back. But he didn't really question it, and he drove me down, right?
So yeah.
I think in terms of like a someone I look up to as a hurdler, for me it would be Liu Jiang. The reason for that is because I'm a minority within the sport. There's not many people of South Asian descent in sport. Very, very few. In fact, you can sort of tell there's a sort of stigma that, you know, brown people are slow. Yeah, maybe they're right in large, but, you know, there's a few of us that are quite quick. So you got to give us some respect in that regard. But, you know, Liu Zhang was a Chinese athlete at 21 years old, equaled the world record, won the gold medal in the Olympics, and was Chinese.
Yeah.
Which no one thought was possible.
Unheard of. Yeah.
You know, you either were black or white, and that was kind of the way, you know, the way it was. And for the most part, you were either black. And if you're lucky and you're white, you maybe got great technique. But Liu Zhang to me proved that you didn't have to be one race or the other. Mm. You actually, any athlete could do it as long as they
were. You have to be good.
Yeah.
Have the attributes, yeah.
For sure. But it meant, it to me, it was a symbol that you weren't genetically limited just purely being either black or white. You could be Chinese. You could be, I mean, even today, there's Japanese athletes who are doing incredibly well. An Indian hurdler I met who was running 13:2. So there's loads of athletes that were from, at the time, was definitely minority backgrounds, who were really showing what they could do. And I think that's a major thing. I remember watching the Olympics just gone, right? And I was watching the javelin. And for me, this is a huge thing, is that it was sort of Johannes Vetter, this German javelin thrower. He was a favorite to win. Mm. And he'd thrown 98 meters.
He was a huge
throw, right? Mm. So everyone thought, okay, shoe in, he's going to win.
Yeah.
And then in comes Chopra, this Indian thrower, who's obviously very talented, you know, you expect him to make a final, but you didn't even expect him to medal, really. Mm. And I remember watching this and thinking, oh God, I really hope he wins for one of two reasons. One, because I like the sport, and I like people who are unexpected to win. That goes without saying. But two, because let's say Vetter did win. Okay, another German won. Congratulations to him. Everyone's happy. Life moves on. But when he threw that winning throw and he won the gold medal, you woke up a sleeping giant, and a billion people suddenly care about this sport that we love so and hold so dear to. He became, I mean, everyone was talking about Sha'Carri Richardson at the time and her social media sensation and how many followers she had on Instagram. He took her out on Instagram with followers like that overnight.
Wow.
Just because he could throw 87 meters at the right time. And to me, that was huge. And it was also a symbol that you didn't have to be Eastern European to win javelin. You know, you didn't have to be Scandinavian. And the same was sort of seen with Julius Yeager, the Kenyan thrower. So I'm definitely very much inspired by these athletes who are what people would assume would have a chance.
And it is funny that the Indian athlete you mentioned, like, you think, well, both China and India, that they're huge, huge population. So you'd think if there was the facilities and resources there, you've got potential Olympic finalists in every event, really, if you have resources. But with India, it's like the how big cricket is. And if you think so many kids throw cricket balls, and that's it's still even in the UK that we get, I know clubs who get a lot of javelin throws through cricket. So you think that there's got to be so many javelin throwers, potential javelin throwers in India, or in any of the cricket playing nations as well. But that's really interesting, because I do remember Jang when was it in the final that he ruptured his Achilles. I think he'd had Achilles issues that season. Mm-hmm. Was it right? Yeah. Was it in the final? Of, I think
he was the face of the Beijing Olympics. And I don't think he even got, I think he got to hurdle one of the heats. He didn't even get beyond that.
Right,
and that was his time done.
That was sad.
Which obviously broke the hearts of the nation. But also the interesting thing was the viewing figures just started going whoop, because people were watching for Liu Zhang. And I think that was a testament to the power that these athletes had. And you know, when you put investment into the sport in any country, you see the results come through, and it stops being so much a cultural thing. It's like, well, yeah, you're going to expect to have a lot of talented athletes from Poland, for example, because they put so much into it.
Yeah.
But is it necessarily because they're born more gifted? I don't believe so. And I think that the consensus back in the day was that it was, and I think it's slowly, of course there are some genetic advantages and disadvantages, but I think that's slowly becoming less the case. Xu Bingqiang, a Chinese athlete, ran 9.86 in the Olympic semi-final.
Yeah,
no one would have thought that would be possible. You know, it's the
norms are being challenged, aren't they? So giving others a chance. Yeah,
sure.
Okay, no, that's really fascinating, Miguel. So I wanted to ask about quickly. Well, you're involved with athletics outside of your own training. And I know you're not doing a lot, but you for someone who's quite young, so you're 25 now. But can you it's really nice to see. Can you explain what you do outside of your actual competing and training?
So I mean, I do a couple of things, but I did for a period of time I just coaching Harrow, a group of youngsters. The tricky thing with hurdles is that there's not a massive wealth of coaches, because it's because of the technical nature of it. It's very difficult to coach and know exactly what you're talking about. You know, it's there's more resources available to teach someone how to coach middle distance or sprints, for example, or even jumps. But hurdles is quite a tricky one. So you often find there's a lot of these athletes that they want to try something, but unfortunately, you know, there's not the opportunity to sort of give it a go and be pointed in the right direction. So I really got a great bit of pleasure out of being able to rock up once a week and put on a hurdle session for the youngsters, who a lot of them, they went and raced and they all ran PBs.
I think that
was an incredibly rewarding experience for me, just to see that not only what you were teaching them was being implemented, but it was also putting a smile on their faces.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of the time as well, crucially, I wouldn't want to teach someone something and then resent what they're doing. I wanted them to enjoy. And I think
some positive experience.
For me, I liked doing hurdles as a youngster because it was something else. It wasn't just running, it was running and something else. And it was a challenge. And I think I saw that a bit in some of the, you know, the youngsters I was coaching alongside with Emily. You know, it's they're getting a kick out of trying to navigate the hurdles, but then also they're kerfuffle because like, oh my god, I have to run fast as well. Oh my god, what?
Yeah.
And a lot of them were from middle distance backgrounds where, you know, the thinking is so different. It's almost like it's tactical, right? Whereas in the hurdles, you can't afford to be tactical because you're going fast. You can't be doing that. It has to be autonomous. So you could see the interesting battle that a lot of these athletes were having mentally rather than actually physically when trying to train. So that was something I definitely enjoyed doing. And then I've recently been accredited as a UKA representative, athlete representative, and I hope to hopefully do the same for the World Athletics process as well. Just got to sit an exam and go through the accreditation sort of side of things, which will hopefully be next year. But I think I definitely want to be able to help athletes get into competitions abroad. I think the thing is that there's a stigma that you're either elite or you're not, and that the only way you can go and experience, you know, competing internationally is purely if you're elite and nothing else. You know, it's the sort of thing that the Diamond League is all there is. There's nothing else. Yeah. So
is this something that you're doing now? You're working on now? Yeah.
Yes. So I'm creating a website called Tudo Sport, and it's hopefully going to launch in February, and it's going to have content resources. So the content side of things is, you know, tips and stuff, you know, technical stuff, you know, for example, beginner level stuff, like let's say it's high jump, how to run a curve, and then, you know, for example, the at an advanced level stuff, it might be stuff like in hurdles, touchdown splits, or you know, benefits of altitude training for even from the particular frame of steeple, not even middle distance, like how does that come into play. And I've been able to build a really good team of people to create stuff like in the steeple, for example, Mark Pierce, he's having a great season, so he's on board and he's making stuff, and through this, the website, which also has like competition database and a performance tool to help you sort of track performances and all of that, there's also the athlete representative stuff. So athletes can go and apply and say, I'd like to compete in this competition.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
Could I get some help? Is it possible to get a lane? And I can go ahead and contact a meeting organizer and try to see what's feasible, you know, tell them what their travel routes are and stuff like that. So that's the other sort of side of things that I'm looking to try to get into next year.
Yeah. That's it's very interesting. You said that, yeah, a lot of athletes think there is just a Diamond League, but there are a whole heap of events that they're not just open meets or fun events. They are, you know, very high caliber, high club standard, or that's sort of level between club and international level, where there are a lot of athletes that they just need that. There is an athlete, I don't know if you know, she's because she runs with Cardiff, I think Jenny Nesbitt, and she's been running 15 something numerous occasions, and I think she's trying to get under 15:30, but she just can't get in the races. She's just constantly running in the UK, winning her races, and that's an example of someone that just needs to get in the right race. And maybe was possibly restricted by COVID travel issues, being able to go abroad. But that's a really that will help a lot of people and give them opportunities to get to the next level.
I mean, it's a different thing entirely racing abroad. For me, a lot of my fastest times have been internationally. And even sometimes, I mean, the thing is, people, like from the frame of the UK, the sport's struggling in the UK. Like even British champs, the crowds aren't massive. But you go to an exhibition event in let's say Poland or something, and it's not even massive elite grand thing. There's people rocking up to watch. There's start lists available the day before going. God forbid you have start lists in the UK. Bloody hell. You know, these sort of things. And that gears it up. It's just a different mindset going and racing against people that you do not know. And having to, you know, get all getting kerfuffled before you even start the race because you're worried about this guy you've raced before beating you and that guy. It doesn't matter if you get beaten.
Yeah.
You're going to race against people who are faster than you, so that you can really, really push yourself, really challenge
yourself.
You know, ultimately, let's say you come last and you walk away with a 5-second PB, right? Then you're not complaining.
If you're trying to get faster and get closer qualification. Why do you think that is? And you mentioned Poland, that there's better crowds and there seems to be more hype about that. Do you think that's because of the culture of the country, or do you think it's because it's promoted? It's a combination of things, or
it is a combination of things. I wouldn't say it's entirely cultural. I think, if I'm honest, I think it's a lot of it's mismanagement. You look in the UK. We have a new world ranking system, right? We have categories of competitions and it goes from F all the way to OW, right? We have two competitions that are above F class, and F class is the same as if you go to an open meeting in Lee Valley, that's the level that F is. We have two competitions and they're both Diamond Leagues. So you're looking at a competition that is completely inaccessible to 99.9% of athletes.
Mm.
And then you're also trying to sell tickets to fill out a stadium that seats 65,000 people, as opposed to a venue that maybe has 10,000 seats and trying to pack it out.
Yeah, get a better atmosphere. Yeah.
And then you're starting to wonder, okay, so why is it that we're not doing well? It's like, well, because you're investing all your things in the top end and you're suggesting to athletes that, right, you're either at the top and or you're not, and we don't care about you. And I've felt that way many, many a time. I think UK is mismanaged things in so many regards.
And I think
it's pretty unanimous amongst the athletes community that that's been the case. I mean, just look at the situation going on currently, right? And it's a similar sort of thing with England athletics. I mean, they try, but I think the problem is that they don't know how to do it the right way. I bring us back to anything. It's like, for example, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is managing Man United. He doesn't want ill for United, but he's not good enough.
And I think that experience, he hasn't got the nails.
No, it's not his. And I think that's exactly the same thing as UKA. And I think it's very much not from the frame of an athlete's perspective or someone coming through the things. It's so top heavy, top end, and nothing for the in between. How many competitions have really been put on?
I think what you said is a good point, and I don't think it's because that. The people don't know how to do it. I think it's the direction from the top that's, and hopefully there is a new CEO, the Ian Beattie, he has got a brilliant track record in Scotland of doing exactly what you said, of promoting a sport within not just the elite end. It's having that vision and everyone behind it. I think there's just too many people who. Yeah, they're trying to think of it as a profit making exercise.
But yeah, it's a business first.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that Ian got appointed, and I was very happy with that because I think Scottish athletics is probably the best, is one of the better run home nations for sure. Perhaps closely tied with Welsh athletics. You know, they're also very much on it.
Yeah.
But you can see that there's someone in place that has experience running. I mean, for me, it doesn't make sense how you had cyclists specialists come and do athletics and then they say, oh, but it's Olympic sport. Yeah, but it's not the same. When you do track cycling, you're not going to compete against a Ugandan cycling team.
You're going
to compete, you know,
against the smaller.
Everyone can run around at 800, you can do 800 meters, everybody. So you're racing against someone from every single country, and not just that, it's not just purely 800 meters. You have people using you have people using poles to launch themselves and mattresses. You have people throwing spears. You know, our sport is so varied, and I think the problem is to bring someone in experience. It is what it is. I like to give the benefit of doubt and say that it's not that they don't know the direction, but you know, as you allude to, at what point do you start questioning and thinking,
there haven't been the results, that it hasn't been good enough. I think we're aware of that. There have been there is some events and that are stronger and there is depth. You look at the state of jumps, look at the state of 400 meter running, Ewan Thomas still has the UK record from 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And he was fast. He was a good athlete, but something's wrong with that record, isn't it? No one's got close to that. And the sport's moved on. Okay, I just want to just go back to one thing that you mentioned about your preparation for hurdles. And just want to ask you about what do you do to prepare psychologically for, mentally prepare for hurdles? There's a lot of athletes out there that don't do hurdles. Because even with sprinting, you don't have the obstacles.
Yeah.
So it is a bit simpler. But how do you prepare for that 13 to 14 seconds of just flat out sprinting?
So is it specifically before a competition?
Well, yeah. What do you do in your training or before? Yeah, but both really. How do you prepare for it?
For me, I don't remember my races. I don't have a single race that I've been able to actually recall what happened. When the gun goes off, I remember going to hurdle one, and then that point, I have flashes of memory, but it's kind of gone. When I do 100 meters, I remember the whole thing. I remember the whole thing. And it's interesting because I train with Jade Williams, and he's a 100, 200 meter guy. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing how he's psychologically dealing with preparing for his event. And his is different to mine. His is almost more, can be more on who he's racing against or nailing first few things. For me, I psychologically prepare by trying not to think about the race at all.
Right.
Because for me, if I've gone into a race and I'm geared up, I'm too overwhelmed, then I'm going to go straight into hurdle one and it's going to be disaster and it's not going to go well. If I can keep myself composed and focused, then when I'm actually doing the warm-up, if I can do the warm-up well and nail it, then I'm able to go into the race and not get overwhelmed. Because it's very easy in hurdles, because the thing is, probably more so than any event in all of athletics, and I can't think of many other examples of anything. If we have seven steps, I have seven steps to the first hurdle, some people have eight. You have a couple of steps to the first hurdle, your head has to come up after two steps. If you don't get that right, the whole race is over. Simple. It's you know, even like, and similar to the 100 meters, but 100 meters you sometimes have a chance to catch up and make up for it. In hurdles, you're done. So if you're overwhelmed and you're not calm enough to take on the race, then you're going to be in trouble. So the thing I will also do as well is I'll think psychologically about in the days before is the technical aspect I want to focus on. And then when I'm in training, I will focus on that particularly. So for example, for a lot of last year, it was ensuring that my trail leg came down and I didn't let it flail out. I let it get to it. As soon as it hit 90 degrees, it's straight into the ground. Yeah. So for me, that cue was down. So the thing I actually remember from the race where I got it right was purely thinking at that frame of time, down. When I was in warm-up, I was, you know, every time I'm doing a trail leg drill, that's all I was thinking, let's just do that. I can get sucked out quite easily. So if I'm thinking about what person A, B, C, or D are doing, for me, I prefer to just not think what they're doing. You do your thing, I don't care. Because it's so easy. Everyone looks like they're going to...
It's all a lot of bravado.
It's a very interesting ecosystem, the athletics warm-up and forum.
Yeah, I was thinking that I remember when I was a kid, I had an athlete that is not running anymore, but he did once, I think we were on a coach going somewhere, and he sat behind me and said, I'm going to beat you. And then I turned around and said, what'd you say? Oh, I didn't say anything. He knew I'd heard, and he did beat me. He got inside my head. And that was the day before, or the day of the race. So he may have beat me anyway. But those psychological games, have you experienced that during your warm-up? Has anyone tried it with you? How did it go?
I've had it a couple of times. I've had it once in particular that sticks in my mind. I mean, I've had the odd person that says, oh, it's not even my main event, and or my hamstring. There's all these athletes who say, oh, my hamstring's hurting, or I'm a bit in pain. It's like, okay, cool. I don't care. But as a kid, you're more susceptible to be like, oh, is he in pain? So if he beats me, then he beat me and he was in pain. Yeah, it doesn't bother me anymore because it's just all this. But I remember one time, I think it was Bucks, I was in the heats. And to be fair, with bucks in the hurdles, you have such incredible variance and ability. Where in the to be fair, because there's such a big gap, you could almost make a mistake and a critical mistake and be fine to qualify for the final if you're one of those guys. So it was about just navigating around and staying composed. I think this one boy said, don't fall over or something like that. And I sort of heard it. I thought, nah, he didn't say that, did he? He didn't say that. I remember thinking it's like, surely he would, because I didn't count as someone who would we were 20. This guy was like 22 or something. I thought, you didn't say that, did you? I think he came fifth in the heat and got knocked out straight away. It's a lot of this.
Yeah.
I mean, Bucks is a strange one because I remember there was one kid who he rocked up and we were doing the warm-up. He's like, "You're right, guys, how you doing? I was like, "You're right, man, how you doing?" He's like, "Yeah. So how do you do these?" I was like, "What do you mean?" It's like, how do you get over? And I was like, "Bro, the race is half an hour. What do you mean?" this poor lad was had obviously never done hurdles before.
No,
signed up to it and didn't know what was going on. He was about 5'5", I think. And I thought, out of all the events to pick, this was not the one for you, my friend. And we had to teach him how to use the blocks and everything. And I at the time I thought, are you trying? I couldn't tell if they were trying to psych me out. If the kid was trying to psych everyone out, I couldn't tell what it was. You know, he ended up running 20 seconds for a 60 meter hurdle. So, you know, he definitely wasn't psyching anyone out, but
at least he didn't get hurt. It helped him.
Yeah, not well. What he did was he went over the first hurdle, nearly killed himself, tried the second one, did hurt, did fall over. And then just went underneath,
just pushed
hurdle 3, 4, and 5 and just walked to the finish line.
It's not an event. You don't blag 110 hurdles.
I mean, fair play 60 meter hurdles. So at the time I thought he was psyching us out.
So what's next for you, Miguel? You may have already said it, but what's your main target then for the winter and this winter and summer?
So for me, our world indoor standard is 7.72. My PB is 87 at the moment, so I want to run that.
PB 787.
Yeah.
And
772 is the standard.
Yeah,
so
okay.
I want to at least run that. Ideally get under 770 and then rock up the champs and do my best. And then going forward, I want to into the outdoor season. I want to, if I can, COVID willing, go and get more international experiences. I don't know how many years I might have left in the sport. So for me, I just want to make sure that I leave it all behind, leave nothing behind rather, and go and get all the experiences I can. And hopefully, run a Commonwealth Games standard or a world, get close to the world championship standard, stuff like that, just really push it and see how fast can I go. When you get closer to the Olympics and stuff like that, you're in a better position to sort of say, okay, well, I'm within 0.05 or you've already ran the standard the year before, so you just have to do it again. Considerably beneficial. So this for me is a bit of a somewhat of a building block here, but also somewhat getting experiences in it
COVID dependent. That's great, Miguel. Super. Okay. Thanks for coming on, Miguel. It's been great talking to you. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I'll speak to you soon.
Cool. Thank you, David. Take care.